Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. Today's installment is from the Shapiro Audio Archive. The Rita and George M. Shapiro Audio Archive is a repository of recordings of religious services, lectures, and concerts that have taken place in Park Avenue Synagogue's historic sanctuary between 1954 and 2004. If you want to learn more about the community or the Shapiro Archives, please visit our website at www.pasyn.org. We hope you enjoy this piece of our Park Avenue Synagogue history.
I'm extremely moved to be here with you this morning. Hadassah, with Rabbi Nadish, with their daughter, we come out of a common seed and a common background. It's interesting that even our daughters pursue somewhat similar paths. I understand that our daughter here today is in law school, and my younger daughter is also in law school. I think the search for justice and truth we hand down from generation to generation. The only difference is that when we handed it down previously from son to son, we now hand it down also from daughter to daughter. And I think that can only be to the good, that we provide an opportunity for all of our children, whether they be male and female, to participate. You know, people always ask me, when I first became interested in women and the role of women and their liberation, and I always say, since the day I was born. But it was really my Zeta that had a lot to do with it all. Naturally, I came from an Orthodox home, and my Zeta, like many of our Zetas, when we were growing up, always took me to shul. And I early learned how to daven, and he was always very proud of me when I davened. He would show me off to all his cronies, and then, of course, since I was brought up in an Orthodox home originally, I would be dispatched to the balcony. And that was always rather difficult for me to understand. I, like you, practice in a conservative synagogue. And what I most appreciate about being here today, to be here on this Sisterhood Sabbath, because it reflects the fact that women's role is changing in halakha. And one of the persons that we can credit for this is both really two persons, Rabbi Nadish in his enormous effort in the Rabbinical Assembly, but Hadassah Nadish, who made a speech in March of 1972, which I was pleased to be able to read under the title, The Jewish Woman, Liberated or Enslaved. In that speech, I think she raised many important questions about the status of Jewish women. And it was most moving for me this morning to see women participating fully side by side with men in the prayer, in the hope, and in the search. Because I believe that this is what is going to bring more meaning into the lives of all people. Last night I spoke in a temple in Rochester, and I was sponsored by the Brotherhood. And I'm therefore very pleased this morning to be sponsored by the Sisterhood. I think that it has a special meaning to all of us. What it means is that we women are prepared not only to seek out rights, but to assume responsibilities. Many have asked me many times why I'm so much concerned with fighting for the rights of women. It's because I'm concerned about society. Because I want to see the total fulfillment of this great country of ours, this democracy, find the way in which it can function and the way in which the priorities are adjusted, a way in which a country which has one of the greatest constitutional histories can also complete that constitutional democracy by opening up its political arms and its economic arms and its social and cultural arms to those who were not thought about originally. It's interesting. Our forefathers wrote a marvelous constitution, but they forgot about the foremothers. Women, As a matter of fact, blacks didn't have a right to vote. We women are only voting since 1920, which happens to be a date I always remember because I was born in 1920. What we seek essentially is a opening up of the political and economic and social cultural life of America so that it can produce more effectively. And until we find the way in which all are involved in it, we can't really accomplish that. You know, when I first ran for office wanting to deal with these problems, my slogan was, "This woman's place is in the House of Representatives." And when I was elected, election night, my older daughter said, "Thank God we got her out of our house into their house." My mother, interestingly enough, who just recently passed away and had an enormous influence on my life, in that she always fostered and supported my desire to participate. My desire to want to find out new things. I remember when I was 11 years old and I was active at that time in the Zionist movement, and I made my first public speeches in the subways of New York collecting Keren Kayemet. And I would go into the subways and I wouldn't just carry the pushkas, I'd stop and make a speech. My father used to scold me for coming home late at night, but my mother always used to say it's what she wants to do. My mother was a widow for many years. Sort of it that my sister and I had education and supported all of the things, though she didn't always agree with me. She thought I worked too hard. But the influence that she had was, I think, interesting. And when I was elected, she said, "I always knew Bella would make it because she practiced and did her homework without being told to do so." I think women in religion, women in education, women in politics, women in the community have played an enormous role. And I think that we are going to continue to do that. And more in crisis times will it be necessary. As you know, we're reaching the end of International Women's Year. This year they gave us a year. Usually we had a day. And I think it's very fitting that this past week, both the House and the Senate approved a bill which I projected providing for funding for a series of women's conferences in the states, culminating in a National Women's Conference to be held in the bicentennial year. It'll give women of all views and background an opportunity to get together to discuss their agreements and disagreements and to help the nation focus on the unfinished business affecting the status of women. We've had so many problems. Women essentially have very little power. When I first came to the Congress, we were 12 women. We are now 19 out of 435. In the Senate, we still have no women. Today, it's only 100 men. And I've always said a stag Senate is a stag nation. But some of us may do something about that. It really is reflected in our work. The more the components of a place of power and a place of decision-making changes, the more there is a reflection of the diversity of needs and demands in the country. And that's really what has been happening in the Congress of the United States by the election of many new members who are younger and more diverse and different. Both Democrats and Republicans have produced programs which are really quite meaningful and has probably worked harder than most Congresses in 100 years. Of course, we've had enormous problems with veto. And this has prevented us from proceeding along the lines that we may have wanted to. We have, you see, an enormous mandate in the Congress from the electorate, a post-Watergate electorate. And yet we have an unelected president for the first time in the history of our country who has a very narrow mandate. As I said to the synagogue or temple last night in Rochester, the mandate is from Grand Rapids, and that's probably even smaller than Rochester. One would think that a non-elected president would exercise power in a restrained way, because there is such a limited mandate, and that there would be a recognition that the reflection of the will of the people is in the Congress. But unfortunately, that has not happened. I want you to know that as far as the question of Israel is concerned, and the question of the concerns of Jews, that the Congress has made me feel very proud. One of my proudest moments in the Congress was when both the House and the Senate unanimously adopted resolutions condemning the UN Assembly action. In the past few days, I've also organized a number of the congresswomen and women's groups to appeal to members of the Assembly not to approve the Declaration of Mexico, which is coming up for vote next week. I happen to have been in Mexico in the International Women's Conference. I was appointed as an advisor to the United States delegation, and I advised the United States delegation to oppose the anti-Zionist resolution that came up there, and they did. And it was sad that it came up there. But it came up there because that conference was manipulated pretty much by governments which are essentially peopled by men, and the same kind of politics that went on at the United Nations went on down there, although most of the women from many of the countries objected to it. So we have recently sent a telegram from the Congress, we women in particular, to make it clear that we all know that Zionism is not the equivalent of racism and that it is the legitimate expression of the national longing of the Jewish people, the people most affected in our generation by the murderous effects of racism. This can only be regarded as a diversion from the legitimate struggle for equal rights among women throughout the world. And we appeal to you to eliminate the anti-Zionist language from the declaration and thus to remove a barrier to peace and understanding among all people. We do what we can. We have to face the fact that there's a very strong and widespread propaganda campaign underway in behalf of the Palestinians. What is not mentioned is that it was the Arab states that were responsible in 1948 for the voluntary departure of the Palestinians and for the elimination of the Palestine state, which the UN had set up, which Israel had accepted. It was the Arab states that chose the policy of keeping the Palestinians segregated in refugee camps instead of integrating them into their nations and society, as Israel did when it welcomed and integrated the 700,000 Jews who were forced to leave Arab lands after the 1948 war. Clearly, there will have at some time to be some resolution of the Palestinian issue. And that is a view which is also held by members of the Israeli government that many of us met with that were recently here. But I see no necessity for Israel to negotiate with the PLO when the PLO does not even recognize the right of Israel to exist. And I want you to know that in the Congress of the United States, there is a similar strong feeling. There is a hope and a belief that we can, in the Congress, continue, and I think we will, to support the demands and the needs of Israel. There is a desire, of course, on the part of the members of Congress to hope and believe that there will be some lasting peace as a result of the steps that have been taken first by the interim agreement and now further negotiations. Those of us who recognize that one of the greatest impetuses for the formation of the United Nations was the suffering and the slaughtering of the Jews under Nazism, find it very tragic indeed that the General Assembly has been transformed into a platform of denunciation of Zionism and incitement against Jews everywhere. I speak now about my colleagues in the Congress. They're very saddened by this, and they're very concerned. And that's why they unanimously passed a resolution in the House and the Senate condemning the use of the United Nations for this kind of platform. And that's why I believe that the Congress of the United States will continue to show its enormous support for the struggle of Israel. I, the other day, read some excerpts to some of my colleagues, trying to explain to them what Zionism really was. And I thought I'd mention them here today. They were in the Times from a speech by Israeli Ambassador Yosef Tekoa, in which he appeared before the United Nations Security Council in 73 to answer the question, what is Zionism? I'd like to quote part of it because I think it expresses important sentiments. And he said the following: when the Jews, exiled from their land in the 7th century before the Christian era, sat by the rivers of Babylon and wept, but also prayed and sought to go home, that was already Zionism. When in the mass revolt against their exile, they returned and rebuilt the temple and reestablished their state, that was Zionism. When they were the last people in the Mediterranean basin to resist the forces of the Roman Empire and to struggle for independence, that was Zionism. When uprooted from their land by the conquerors and dispersed by them all over the world, they continued to dream and to strive to return to Israel, that was Zionism. When they formed the Jewish Brigade in the Second World War to fight Hitler, while Arab leaders supported him, that was Zionism. And when the Jews went to gas chambers with the name of Jerusalem on their lips, that was Zionism. It is that unconquerable spirit which has enabled the Jewish people to survive as a people, and which is now enabling Israel to survive as a nation. It is that unconquerable spirit which has won the respect and commitment of the American people, as well as the Congress of the United States. I think, however, we would be deluding ourselves, and I would be deluding you, if we regarded that support as immutable or impenetrable. We all know that anti-Semitism exists in high places. We have only to recall the anti-Semitic remarks made last year in a speech by General Brown, the Army Chief of Staff. I called for his ouster. A lot of people criticized me for doing that among my colleagues, but many of them supported my position. I originally and subsequently was very disturbed too about the invitation to President Sadat of Egypt to address a joint session of Congress because he used his visit here to make anti-Semitic remarks, although I view his comparatively forward-looking stance as important, namely his effort to create the Sinai Pact and the recent passage of an Israel-bound ship through the Suez Canal as positive achievements. I still object to allowing anyone to address a joint session of Congress who has been guilty of anti-Semitic remarks as he was when he came into this country. I understand, too, that there have been some private polls which indicate that although the American people still overwhelmingly favor Israel as against the Arab nations, that there's been some erosion of support for aid to Israel because of a feeling that the United States must handle its very severe economic problems. We have a stake in those severe economic problems as Americans, as people who are affected by the American economy, as well as Jews who want to make sure that we can provide for ourselves, our own, as well as for others. Hadassah was right. Of course, it's our background that motivates us. Of course, a strong sense that Hadassah has and her family has and that I have was imbued in us for social justice, for equality, for economic opportunity, for an understanding of people who differ with us. We have an enormous stake as Americans and as Jews in setting right some of the terrible inequities in society. Not only inequities man towards woman or man towards man, but inequities of rich towards poor. I mean, this is a country that's going to be 200 years old. It was born in revolution. Our forefathers and our foremothers came to this country seeking that economic opportunity, that social justice and political and religious freedom. We still seek it. We find ourselves in a country which today is facing inflation and recession, where as a matter of policy of government, we have statements that the way in which we fight inflation is to have as an affirmative policy the maintenance of unemployment rates of 7-8% or more for some years to come. It's now upwards of 9%, and much more serious for women and minorities and young people who have been the first fired after being the last to be hired. We have an unimportant tradition. We have a great country. It provides for the greatest freedoms that all other countries fail to have, or most other countries. We have the freedom to speak, we have the freedom to write, we have the freedom to assemble. We have to keep fighting for those freedoms and to keep them. There are those who always want to take them from us, but we have it. But that's not substantive enough. As we move into the bicentennial, we have a responsibility to say that unless a country that is the richest in democracy and in our resources provides also a fundamental right to every human being who can to work, to provide the bare essentials of clothing, of food and shelter, then we have failed in democracy. Unless we're able to provide for young people the opportunity to study, to go to school, regardless of their background, without having to fight for admissions, without having to fight for the opportunity that we now confront and then are placed in the positions of fighting around the issue of quotas, then we have failed. We are rich enough to be able to provide educational institutions for all who want to learn. Unless the elderly in our society can feel less thrown on the junk pile of despair as they now do, then we have failed. We as Americans and as Jews have a particular interest in seeing to it that we examine policies that may have to change the way in which we have functioned. Why shouldn't we have a full employment program so that we can stimulate not only employment but the whole question of production and industry in our country? Why shouldn't we do as other countries do in Europe? When unemployment reaches a certain stage, there's an expenditure to create the jobs which then help to stimulate the industry. We don't, because although we've been through Watergate, we have not yet freed ourselves of the special interests that still very much dominate the power structures of our country. We argue greatly about Israel in the Congress today. We argue about the economy. Our colleagues say to us, well, we have a problem about getting along ourselves. And those of us who argue against that position say, you and the public has to gain a deeper understanding of the United States' record on aid to Israel. Before 1973, Israel received no military assistance in the form of outright grants, even though more than 90% of all American assistance for military purpose was in grant form rather than in sales. In 1973, in response to the Yom Kippur War, Israel was granted or voted $2.18 billion worth of credits, and she was eventually relieved of having to pay $1.5 billion of that amount. This year, Israel asked for $3 billion. The administration is requesting $2.24 billion. That includes $724 million for support services and an arms request of $1.5 billion, of which half will have to be repaid by Israel. It's interesting. The total United States defense budget has a ceiling of $101 billion. And I can assure you that there is a great deal of fat in that budget, a great deal of unnecessary expenditures that can be eliminated without jeopardizing in any way our national security, and without jeopardizing in any way our national and international responsibility to aid and support a democratic nation like Israel in its fight for survival. Some of my colleagues argue with me. Well, if you want aid for Israel, you've got to give us everything else we want. Why should I have to be blackmailed into that? Why should any American have to be blackmailed into that when just recently the administration admitted that it had wasted $5 billion on the anti-ballistic missile? $5 billion, a weapon system that many of us in Congress had opposed as useless and as a boondoggle. We predicted that we would have to withdraw from that program, and we did. Finally, the administration, after 4 or 5 years of struggle, which we have conducted in the Congress, has finally succeeded in phasing it out. But think of how we could have used that $5 billion to meet the needs of Americans that have been so long neglected, let alone the needs of a democratic nation like Israel for assistance, the needs for jobs and housing, the needs for better health care. We've been struggling in this country with trying to find a way to have better health services and the better delivery of health services. And there are lots of problems with it. But we are at least 100 years behind nations in Europe that have been providing a national health program regardless of people's ability to pay. What about the needs of our senior citizens? You need only walk about the city of New York today, and you will find person after person in almost total despair among senior citizens because they don't know what tomorrow will bring. Many people in this city and in cities and in rural areas all over this state that I have visited, as well as all over this country, are in utter fear of today as well as tomorrow because of an inability to provide for themselves in this terrible, raging inflationary period. I think we have to develop some perspective on how and for what we spend our money. And viewed in the context of a $100 billion military budget, a grant of $1.5 billion to save democratic Israel is modest indeed, especially when we consider that the United States is helping Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations to modernize their armed forces. The truth is that the executive branch of our government recently, in particular, and it has in the past, been very accommodating towards the Arab nations and towards their discriminatory practices. As chairwoman of the House Government Operations Subcommittee on Individual Rights, I held hearings which showed that when the United States sends missions to countries that discriminate against Jews or women or blacks, it excludes American citizens that fall under these categories. This is illegal, of course, but that doesn't stop various government agencies from collaborating with Arab nations and discriminating against Americans. It got very bad, so a few weeks ago, I and 24 of my colleagues in the House filed a lawsuit against Secretary of Commerce Rogers Morton and Secretary of Interior Thomas Kleppe, charging them with failing to implement a 10-year-old United States policy against foreign trade boycotts. As you read in the papers, I'm sure at the same time a House subcommittee had found that Mr. Morton was guilty of contempt of Congress because he refused to release this information on the subject that the Congress and the public and the world had a right to know. Some of that information has been made available. But in the meantime, an anonymous official in the Commerce Department disclosed the other day that in nearly 3/4 of 50,000 trading transactions with Arab countries since 1970, American companies have refused to tell the United States government whether they were going along with Arab boycott demands. The official said this indicates that in most, if not all of these transactions, these American companies were indeed complying with the Arab demands involving a boycott of Israel. He explained that this did not mean that these companies were necessarily not trading with Israel, but rather were operating under restrictive conditions. Well, we're getting some of this information. And I believe that if these American companies are guilty of flagrantly violating the declared public policy of our country by collaborating with the Arab boycott, then their names should be made known to their stockholders and competitors and customers. I don't want to give you the impression that I don't understand, because I've been in government now for the last 5 years, and so I do understand that there are times when government has to operate behind closed doors, especially when it's involved in a delicate diplomatic negotiation. But unfortunately, we have learned through our very bitter experience that too often the closed door and excuses about national security are used to cover very serious excesses, which have included not only wiretapping and burglary and opening of mail, but murder plans and attacks on the rights of American people themselves. It's really quite shocking. We have to conduct these investigations day in and day out. We don't want to. I, as chairwoman of Government Information Individual Rights Subcommittee, in dealing with the Freedom of Information Act and the Privacy Act, have held any number of hearings, some of you may have noticed, involving the CIA and the IRS. It's shocking what government has been permitted to do for so many, many years because of false assumptions. Right after Hiroshima, somehow or other, a fright went through this land. And we came of the view that government was going to be powerful and controlled, not because it was democratic, not because we had the greatest history and the greatest technology and the greatest culture and the greatest capacity to make things work and were the richest country in the world, but because we had the nuclear bomb. And we used that to govern instead of the sovereign will of the American people. And that's why over many years, people have abdicated their rights to govern. The people themselves and legislative bodies like the Congress. And that's why so much power has been placed in the hands of the executive. I have a file. Probably some of you in this room have a file. We find that most members of Congress have lots of files in the FBI, which people have been collecting about us for many, many years. During the time we're in Congress, they're still collecting information about us. I mean, what kind of stuff have they got? They classify newspaper clippings. And one of the things that they did in my file was they had an interesting newspaper clipping, a story by Sally Quinn, who some of you may know. She writes for the Washington Post, used to be on NBC. She was supposed to compete with Barbara Walters, but she didn't quite make it. Anyhow, she went to this event that I had in the Lower East Side. When I was first elected, I was represented both the West Side and the Lower East Side. And so naturally, when we had a party, a fundraiser to collect funds, where would we hold it? We held it in Katz's Delicatessen. And Katz's Delicatessen, you could have all the corned beef you wanted at this party, and we had music and so on and so forth. And they had this whole story about my fundraising event at Katz's Delicatessen. Well, if you've been there, you know it's down on Houston Street. It's a place where they have big salamis that are hanging from the ceiling. And they have an old sign hanging behind the salamis which say, "Send a salami to your boy in the army." Obviously, the CIA thought there was something in those salamis. I mean, they opened mail. They followed people. They wiretapped. They've inquired, all in the name of national security. Now, there are issues of national security, but it has been used not only by ex-President Nixon, but by the FBI and the IRS and the CIA, which are the vehicles and the mechanisms through which a person like Mr. Nixon sought to assume and get enormous control. It's been used to tyrannize people in this country, to make people conform, to prevent people from speaking out, to prevent people from really keeping democracy alive. The greatness of democracy, its dynamics. It is that we do have a right to differ. And out of this comes new ideas, and out of this comes an evaluation of old ideas, and out of this comes change and progress. And when that doesn't exist, then we have nothing. Then we have nothing. And that's why once there was a total exposure of this terrible problem of Watergate, we've had to continue to cleanse the vehicles and the mechanisms of democracy from the taint. And that's why we have all these investigations. It's not that we haven't got other things to do. We're very busy. We have much to do. But we will never have economic democracy until we have political democracy. That's part of it. Because it's only those who have enormous economic power, more than anybody in this room, even the richest of you, that wants to control the rights and the reins of government so that others may not participate as well as they in both the political and economic deserts of this nation. And so I believe that government at all levels has to be responsive to the people and responsible to the people who elected them, or even responsible to the people who selected them. We'd have a terrible problem now between the executive and the legislative branch. As I mentioned to you before, Gerald Ford is the first non-elected president in the history of our nation. I personally thought there should have been an election. I couldn't get people to agree with me. And later on, there was a poll which showed that a majority agreed with me. In any case, he was handpicked by a discredited and impeachable president. He got the pardon, and we got Gerald Ford. Because we are in this very extraordinary situation, we have to be more vigilant about our rights than ever before. Currently, my subcommittee is working on a bill. We opened up all of the sessions of Congress. We opened up all of our committee sessions to the public and the press, because the tremendous need for the right to know, particularly after Watergate, became a very pressing reform. Now we're working on a bill which is euphemistically referred to as the Sunshine Bill, which will open up the meetings of administrative agencies to the public. And you can imagine there are a lot of people complaining about it, but we're going to have that bill. It was passed in the Senate, and we hope to pass it in the House. And it would require that all activities be open to the public. Let the sun shine in. Let the public know what their elected representatives are doing in their name with their tax dollars. There are enormous pressures in this country still trying to move us in the direction of strict federal control over the lives and thoughts of American citizens. Even as we investigate, even as we try to restore the balance of democracy that has been so distorted through this period of abdication of the power of people and the power of Congress to the executive branch, there are still pressures moving in the other direction. And I was very stunned to read and find out the other day that our own new Attorney General, Edward Leavy, told the Senate committee that he favors guidelines to allow the FBI to obstruct or prevent groups from acting if it affects government before they even do anything. Now, that's in that old tradition, and it's an outrageous proposal to be made to a committee which has been hearing a series of horror stories about the FBI's interfering in legitimate domestic political activity, manipulating organizations, and doing all the kinds of things that you read in the newspapers and I don't have to enumerate here today. What I'm trying to say is that we're in an economic crisis. We still haven't cleansed the political process of those who sought to assault it or the practices which have demeaned it. We're working on that. We have to strengthen our democracy because we have an economic crisis in this country, an economic crisis in many places in the world, and a political crisis. We also have a survival crisis. We spend $100 billion in arms. The countries of the world spend $250 billion a year on armaments. When millions are hungry. When people, even as I said before, in this, the richest country of all, don't have jobs or enough food or decent housing. We're involved in a terrible nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. We're having talks that are supposed to be detente. And there is, in the opinion of many, a period of what we're going through in which the nuclear doomsday clock is ticking away. We have to find the ways, as we're doing in the most difficult places, as the interim agreement between Egypt and Israel indicates, to find the ways in which nations can settle their disputes peaceably around the table. It's very difficult to do in the case of Israel, with the PLO demanding the destruction of Israel. It's very difficult to do, and I hope with you, as we all do, that there will be some Palestinians that will accept the fact that there is a state of Israel and they have to survive, and that then perhaps some of the issues involving the Palestinians can be solved, but certainly not by the PLO, as long as it continues to demand and to deny the survival of Israel. There are other places of conflict in the world. You read on the front pages what's going on in Angola. We're in there, China's in there, the Soviet Union is in there, Cuba is supposed to be in there, we're all supplying arms, we're all in there. What about those people in Angola? Just like we were all in many different periods in Vietnam, when we had no right to be there. I mean, over these things, a nuclear war can arise. In the ultimate, therefore, we are people who have lived not by the sword. We who are people of peace have to think about how we accomplish that, even as we struggle every day, to give the economic and military assistance that Israel wants. We do it because we hope that thereby we strengthen Israel so that she can fight for peace. In the last analysis, for a way in which she can find peace, and a lasting peace in the Middle East is the only ultimate solution to our problems. $250 billion a year on armaments, more and more nations joining the nuclear club can only threaten the survival of the universe itself. And so, peace, in my judgment, must remain our strongest goal. Because only with a world at peace or a country at peace are we going to find the security for our own people and the security for peoples elsewhere to develop the kinds of needs that they have. It's not only the United States. Israel spends its budget for war. America spends its budget for war. The Soviet Union spends its budget for war. Countries all over spend their budgets for war, and it's the people ultimately who suffer. And therefore, the only meaningful way in which we're going to solve some of the terrible problems in this country or elsewhere is to find the goals of peace. A world in peace is the only kind of world where the dreams that we all have, whatever they are, for a better life for all people can actually achieve reality. In closing, I want to share with you a poem that some of you may have read, written by a young Israeli girl from Beersheba, which expresses these views. I had a box of colors, shining bright and bold. I had a box of colors, some warm, some very cold. I had no red for the blood of wounds. I had no black for orphan grief. I had no white for dead faces and hands. I had no yellow for burning sands. But I had orange for the joy of life. And I had green for buds and nests. And I had blue for bright, clear skies. I had pink for dreams and rest. I sat down and painted peace. So let those of us who are gathered here tonight, today, help the children, our children and others of all nations, paint peace, because in so doing, we may find our more significant solutions.
Thank you for joining Park Avenue Podcasts. You have been listening to a selection from the Rita and George M. Shapiro Audio Archive. If you want to learn more about the community or the Shapiro Archive, please visit our website at www.pasyn.org. We hope you enjoyed this piece of our Park Avenue Synagogue history. See you in shul.